Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
If you are feeling lonely or disconnected, if you're feeling unseen or unheard or invalidated by other people, please know that it makes sense that you feel this way and that anybody in your situation would be feeling what you're feeling. And so if possible, consider taking some time to reflect on what's been happening. And if possible, see if you can provide a compassionate response to what you're going through, because you deserve to be seen, to be heard, to be valued, to be reminded that you matter. And I hope that you know that you're wonderful. You're absolutely wonderful, and you make a difference in this world.
That was Dr. Janina Scarlett on Psychologists of the Clock.
We are four experts in psychology here to bring you cutting-edge and science-based ideas from psychology to help you flourish in your relationships, work, and health.
I'm Dr. Debbie Sorensen, a clinical psychologist practicing in Mile High, Denver, Colorado, and author of Act for Burnout, Act Daily Journal, and the Act Daily Card Deck.
From America's Heartland, I'm Dr. Emily Edlin, a clinical psychologist based in Chicago, Illinois, and author of Autonomy Supportive Parenting.
Calling in from Vienna, Austria, I'm Michael Herold, ACT coach, confidence trainer, and author of an upcoming book on being a better conversationalist and making friends.
And from coastal New England, I'm Dr. Jill Stoddard, author of Be Mighty, The Big Book of ACT Metaphors, and Imposter No More.
We hope you take what you learn here to build a rich and meaningful life.
Thank you for listening to Psychologists Off the Clock.
We all know there are trade-offs in life, like having to drive a little further to save on gas or groceries. But when it comes to your health, you shouldn't have to trade off. So don't go back to that one doctor who's always late and rushes through your appointment just because they're close by or they take your slightly sketchy insurance. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable, listen to you, and prioritize your health. You can search by location, availability, insurance, literally no trade-offs here, because with ZocDoc, you've got more options than you know. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. My kid's pediatrician is retiring this summer, so you can bet I will be using ZocDoc to find someone new who we all love and trust. So go to ZocDoc.com/POTC and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/POTC. ZocDoc.com/POTC.
Small behaviors can make a big difference in our health and well-being. Most of us work so many hours each week that we should think about how our work habits affect our bodies. Being able to stand sometimes while I work has made a huge difference for me. Uplift Desks has created high-quality office furniture designed to help you work better and live healthier. My Uplift standing desk allows me to easily transition from sitting to standing while I work with just the push of a button. I feel so much better than when I sit all day, and it helps me recharge to change positions when I get tired in the afternoon. In addition to standing desks, Uplift offers ergonomic office seating, storage systems, even walking treadmills for your desk. You can get free shipping with no hassles, free 30-day returns and return shipping, and a 15-year warranty. Remember, by supporting our sponsors, you're supporting the podcast. Visit UpliftDesk.com/POTC for 5% off your order. That's UpliftDesk.com/POTC to get 5% off your entire order.
I'm here today with Jill to talk about my interview with Dr. Janina Scarlett. So Jill, tell me, what did you think of my discussion with Janina.
Well, Michael, I think first I have to say, I don't want to embarrass you, but this was your first official POTC interview, and I just thought you did such a great job, and listeners are going to love this first exposure to you. Of course, they were exposed to you when we did the introduction episode, but this was your first episode as an official POTC co-host interviewer, and I thought you did a great job, and listeners
Thank
are going to love
Thank
this.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
And as you know, and I'm not sure if listeners know, but I've known Janina for a really, really long time. I was her professor. She was my student. She worked for me for a long time. And so it was really special to get to hear two of my favorite people, two people who mean a lot to me, have this conversation with each other.
Such a small world.
I know.
Yeah.
It really is. And, you know, so there were a lot of things that jumped out at me. And one was you don't tend to feel lonely a lot, but then you did this assessment and realized maybe you were a little more lonely than usual. And it really stuck out to me, the different ways you guys talked about how people might feel unseen. You know, the name of the book is Unseen, Unheard, Undervalued. And, you know, you talked about feeling unseen often when you're in your wheelchair out in public. And I had this thought, gosh, yeah, since I've turned 50, I really feel unseen. Like, you know, you kind of hear about how middle-aged women just become like invisible at a certain place. And what that really made me think about is like, even though I don't feel particularly lonely, and I think the reason for that is because I've really curated my group of people, my friends and family, and the people that I choose to stay in touch with. And that sometimes means a smaller group, but a more connected group. And that's one of the pieces of advice that Janina gives. But it really made me just kind of go, oh, wow, how many humans are walking around feeling this way? And that this is probably something I need to start even explicitly asking my clients about.
You know, I've recently started doing something that was not inspired by the book. It was just something that I wanted to bring more into my life. And that is when I talk with service personnel at the checkout lane in the supermarket, gas station, I make a point in making sure I don't have headphones in, and I look them in the eye at one point. And I'm getting goosebumps just talking about this now, because there's this short human moment where maybe for the first time in an hour, someone actually saw that person at the checkout lane when they said, thank you, have a great weekend. There's really like, it's almost like sparks are flying a little bit between those eyes. And
that's,
I think
that's so simple to do, that takes no time, that takes no effort. Like, we have these opportunities to connect with people in small ways that could really make a difference in this epidemic of loneliness.
Yeah. And I mean, we do those things that are so rote, the how are you? Thank you so much. Have a great day, which is just like on autopilot. It just comes out of our mouth, and making that little bit of extra effort of making eye contact seems to really change the game.
I love that. And it sounds like when you're doing that, you're really present and maybe even savoring that moment. And if people listen toward the end, you and Janina have a whole conversation about savoring that I just loved, like really showing up to these moments and not just being present, but like taking them in and eking out the goodness of them. And it made me think about this metaphor that I've actually shared on the podcast before, but I wrote about it in my book, Imposter No More. And I've had two people separately reach out to say, you have to share this on social media with people because it impacted them so much. And when you and Janina started talking about savoring, I thought, oh my gosh, this is the lemon metaphor. So it felt like the universe was saying, Jill, you gotta share this.
What's the lemon metaphor? Okay. Now I need to hear it.
Let me give credit where credit is due. So this idea first originated from my friend Hank Robb, who I know through the Association for Contextual Behavioral Sciences. And so what Hank said to me during this meeting, we had a meeting during COVID, and he had been talking to a patient where he said, they say when life hands you lemons, make lemonade. But it's pretty hard to make lemonade if you don't have any sugar. And sometimes the best you can do is just try to avoid the juice being squirted in your eye. And that's where he ended the metaphor. And I thought, oh, that's great. And that's really validating of what people are going through when they're having a hard time. But then I kept thinking about it more. And this is where the savoring comes in. And I thought, you know, I think even in the darkest times, there's always a little bit of sugar, even if it's just a granule. And those granules are the places where we show up and savor small moments. Mm-hmm. Like, so for me during that time, or even now, like if I come home and I haven't seen my kids and my dog in a while and they're screaming down the hallway, you know, mommy! And I know they'll be fighting again in 15 seconds, but soaking in that moment of the hugs and the love, and you may only get a couple of those in a day, but when you show up and you savor them, I think that's where you get the sweetness to make the lemonade. And it just really reminded me of this conversation that you had with Janina about the importance of savoring. And it had never occurred to me that it could be part of the sort of antidote to loneliness. And it really made sense in the way that, those two things relate.
It's one of those small ingredients of life, just like core values, which I talk about with Janina as well, where if we add values, if we add savoring, then a day where we didn't reach our goals, we didn't do everything we wanted to do, we failed left, right, and center, but we were still fully alive in that day because there were these small moments and there were these values that we brought in, even though the only thing we tried to do was not to squirt lemon juice into our eyes.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I hope you enjoy this interview with Dr. Janina Scarlett. Dr. Janina Scarlett is a licensed clinical psychologist, an award-winning author, and a full-time geek. She's a Ukrainian-born refugee who survived the Chernobyl nuclear disaster and persecution. She immigrated to the United States at the age of 12 with her family. And inspired by the X-Men, she developed superhero therapy to help patients with anxiety, depression, and PTSD. For her work on superhero therapy, Dr. Scarlett received the Eleanor Roosevelt Human Rights Award by the United Nations Association. She's been featured on more media outlets than I could list in the time that we have here, and she regularly consults on books and TV shows, including the amazing show The Young Justice on HBO. Janina is also the only person that I know that has been turned into a character in a graphic novel, and she's a return guest on the show. We had her on the show in the summer of 2020 together with Sarah Scherer. That was episode 147. So today, we're going to talk about her most recent book, Unseen, Unheard, Undervalued, Managing Loneliness, Loss of Connection, and Not Fitting In. Welcome to the show, Janina.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited.
Me too. So when I read your book, I realized that it's so much more than about loneliness. I felt like I read a book literally on what it's like to be a human being. So maybe we can start at the beginning. What made you write that book?
You know, for me, loneliness has been such a close companion. And I think it's a feeling that I've been trying to run from since I was a small child, because I was told from an early age that if you're feeling lonely, you're just being ungrateful and you're just forgetting that you're so blessed and you have your family, you have your friends, you just need to think differently and focus on the good things. And I essentially internalized this message as there was something wrong with me. And I spent many decades of my life feeling lonely and then feeling ashamed about feeling lonely. And the more I had been working as a psychologist, the more I realized that this feeling of loneliness is as universal as feelings of sadness and grief and fear and anger. And I believe that it is one of the universal human emotions that most people don't talk about. And so I wanted to destigmatize the experiences of loneliness and to unwrap what they are, what they might look like, and to show some examples from my life and my clients' lives and my friends' lives so that people can hopefully, when they're reading it, say, hey, me too, I've been through that also, and to start naming these experiences and talking about it so that we can come together as a society to support one another when we're feeling lonely.
Maybe we start there then and just define loneliness. What is loneliness? How does it feel like? And also, what is not loneliness? Because I can imagine that there's also some confusion around the term.
Absolutely. So loneliness is an emotion of disconnect. It's where we feel like other people don't quite understand what we're going through or don't want to understand, or when people are invalidating us or ignoring our needs, or perhaps when people are shaming or bullying us. All of those are experiences of loneliness. What's not necessarily loneliness is being physically alone. Although we can feel lonely when we're physically alone, sometimes we might choose to spend some time by ourselves. We call it solitude. And that's actually a self-compassion practice. Going on a mindful walk or drawing or reading by ourselves can be recharging when it's something that we do as a choice, right? Something to restore our internal battery. And as a proud introvert, I need a lot of solitude time to recharge my battery in order to do the work that I do. And so a lot of people, especially during the pandemic, thought that physical being by ourselves is the same thing as the feeling of loneliness. And it's not. We know that when we feel emotionally supported by other people, whether it's in person or virtually, as we're connecting right now, we can get through just about any hardship in our life. But when we feel unseen, unheard, undervalued by other people, we might feel even lonelier when we're around them. And that's why some people say they're feeling lonelier in a crowd of people who don't understand them than they do by themselves sometimes.
So there's quite a disconnect between the number of people that we have or do not have around us and feeling lonely. So I could be a high school kid amongst hundreds of other kids and still feel lonely, which is, by the way, a very true story of mine. And at the same time, also a very true story of mine during the pandemic, connecting with people all across the world through Zoom, through messengers, through voice messages, and just having like such a vibrant social life that it was almost weird to think that this is actually a lockdown. Like I'm actually supposed to physically isolate when emotionally I could surround myself with so many supportive people that see me, hear me, and value me, because you have these three adjectives in the book title. Maybe we can just dig into each one a little bit more, because you make such a clear distinction between them, or I should say you explain it so well how each one of them feels and what emotions that is connected to.
So feeling unseen is when we feel invisible, erased, when we might be ignored. So an example I have is I was out with my partner. We were going for a walk and we ran into one of his friends who I found out later has some misogynistic tendencies. This person said hello to my partner, did not say hello to me, completely ignored me, and asked my partner if he was interested in hanging out and traveling, like going to a cabin. And it sounded like it, you know, it wasn't necessarily an exclusive activity to the two of them, but I was completely excluded despite being right there. And so I felt completely invisible. And so this might seem like such a small thing, but in this, I felt not only little, I felt completely erased.
Yeah.
We see this happening a lot when people's, let's say, cultural identity or gender identity or sexual orientation is erased, right? When people are not being called by the correct name or the correct gender pronoun. And so what might come up when we're feeling invisible or unseen is we might feel sad, we might feel hopeless or helpless and defeated. Unheard, on the other hand, a lot of times elicits feelings of anger. And so when we're unheard, it's when we are invalidated. Sometimes we might be gaslighted, eliciting to feelings of not just anger, but also confusion. We might start doubting ourselves. And then finally, undervalued is when we might be shamed or embarrassed, right? Bullied and sort of getting the unwanted attention from other people. And so all of these are experiences of loneliness when we don't feel emotionally safe and supported the way that we ought to be.
And it's so interesting how before reading your book, I would not have connected being lonely with an emotion of being angry. But yeah, if you're not hurt, that makes total sense. I have many examples around this, but my favorite example, because it was actually my mom who pointed this out to me, that at this point I was completely unseen, was when I am traveling with the train using my wheelchair. I always have someone from the train station come and help me, and they have like a ramp and they make sure I get on the train. And that works really fine unless I am being accompanied by a family member. Because in that case, they talk to my mom, they talk to my brother, they don't talk to me anymore. It's like, is he going to sit there? Does he have luggage? And I'm like, hey, this guy's like, I'm literally like here. And it was so interesting when first my mom pointed this out to me, and then my brother pointed out to me and said, why is this guy like talking to me all the time? And yeah, it is isolating. I mean, in this particular case, I could, you know, laugh about it a little bit to myself and find the humor in the situation. But it does evoke a lot of, yeah, wait, like I'm here. I'm present. I'm not wearing an invisibility cloak right here, right now. Yeah.
Yes. And thank you so much for bringing up that example. You're not the first person to have shared this with me, that people with disabilities often get ignored and their family members are talked to about that individual as if that person isn't there. And it's very disrespectful. And yes, that facilitates the feeling of being unseen. And I'm so sorry that that happens to you. It is not okay. And I'm really glad that you bring this up. And I imagine there are so many other people out there that can relate to this.
I would think so, yes. And at the same time, the mindset I'm going to in those situations is I'm trying to, for the lack of a better word, correct the situation as much as I can. Sometimes with a little bit of dark humor, sometimes with just being direct. A good example is that whenever someone is guiding me through a crowd or into the train, they would say, hey, please make some room. There's a wheelchair coming. It's like, actually, you know, there is a person in a wheelchair coming right now. And the way that I would then, you know, with a little bit of dark humor, retaliate is I would call them a uniform. It's like, hey, can't you listen to the uniform? And then it's so nice to see like how that connects with them. Like in the background, it's like, oh, wait, I'm getting this. And at the same time, I was at a anime and manga convention 2 weeks ago. And there was this one lady who said, hey, can you please make some room? There's a gentleman in a wheelchair coming. And I turned to her and I said, you know what? Thank you. Like, that is really rare. Thank you so much for doing that.
Yeah, it feels so wonderful to be seen, doesn't it? When we're able to be recognized and acknowledged by other people.
So in that regard, something else that really stood out to me in the book was when you were talking about that feeling of shame, which is also something that I personally have dealt a lot with. And your chapter referencing Brené Brown as well talks about shame as something that is pretty much like, you know, human. Like that's very, very normal. Not necessarily that we want to feel shame, but it is part of the human experience. And leads to self-isolation and therefore to loneliness as well.
Absolutely. And actually, one of the chapters I wrote was about my experience of shame and my shame spiral that I went through when I realized I was giving the wrong presentation to a wrong audience.
Oh yeah, tell that story, please.
Oh my goodness. So I was about halfway through a presentation to a Zoom room full of people. And then I realized, oh my goodness, I am presenting the wrong presentation to the wrong audience. So I was hired to do a presentation for veterans in terms of how to manage mental health. And just the day before, I had given another presentation for mental health providers who treat veterans. And I ended up using the same presentation. So now I'm giving a presentation targeted toward mental health professionals who treat veterans and using statements such as, when you're a mental health professional working with veterans. And in the meantime, I'm presenting to veterans. And so partway through, I realized my mistake and I self-corrected and, you know, I addressed it to veterans, but the damage had been done.
That must have been quite a pivot in a live session to turn this around into a new direction.
And so on the slides, it did say like, when your client does X, you know, so I would say when you feel X, you know, so I would kind of like rephrase it. But the shame I started feeling at that point during the session and then for weeks afterwards, it was probably one of the most humiliating things I've ever felt. One of the most shameful things, I should say, not humiliating, shameful would be the correct Brené Brown definition here. One of the most shameful experiences I've ever been through. And for me, I went inward like so many of us do when we shame spiral. And so I was internally punishing myself. So after the session was over, I was basically mentally abusing myself. I was calling myself names and saying, how could you do this? You're such an idiot. And, you know, and much harsher words that we're not going to say here. And what I was doing was not just self-isolating, I was perpetuating the shame spiral. And I think that when we are in shame, when we isolate as a way of avoidance, which is completely what I was doing, we tend to feel worse. And another option here is either to reach for support, right? To reach out to our friends for support and validation, trusted friends, or to spend some time in reflection and solitude in terms of thinking about, okay, this is what happened. What are my options? How do I want to respond to this? What would be the most core values-based action that I can take that would allow me to maybe support this population, for example, right? And so I was able to reach out to the coordinator for the presentation and offered to, first of all, I asked to not be paid for the presentation. I asked to give another presentation free of charge. And so these were core values-based actions. But I think that when any of us, myself included, spend that time isolating as opposed to either reaching out for help or spending time in solitude, we tend to feel worse. And so it's interesting, right, that the same action, such as taking time alone, can have a different impact depending on the intention. If the intention is, I don't want to be around other people because I don't deserve to be because I'm so terrible, and I don't want to feel this, then we tend to feel worse. And so for some people, it might be wallowing, it might be engaging in certain unhelpful behaviors, right? Using certain substances or over engaging in, let's say, video games or binging television shows, which there's nothing wrong with playing video games or watching television shows. But when we're doing it for the sole purpose of not feeling, we feel worse. On the other hand, if we tell ourselves, okay, I'm distressed, let me play this game for a little bit, or let me watch a couple of episodes of the show so that I can soothe and then I can figure out the course of action, we feel better. We feel differently. And so I think the intention that we choose to take in response to shame can change how we feel and then also how we react after.
And to dig a little bit into the concept of core values that you've just mentioned. So a core values is a concept out of acceptance and commitment therapy. And the idea is that instead of working solely with goals, desired outcomes, you work with core values, which are more like flavors to behavior that you can kind of bring into every situation that you find yourself in.
Exactly. And so, for example, if one of my core values is helping people, then a core values-based action, also known as committed action, might be to offer to do a presentation or offering to support people in my community. So that would be a goal-based behavior, right? Kind of a one-off behavior that supports the core value of helping others.
The beautiful thing about core values is that they are completely under our control, meaning that they're not always easy to do that committed action. And at the same time, like to use this podcast episode as an example, like our goal for this episode might be that 8 billion people listen to it and then it gets turned into a book series and James Cameron makes a VFX heavy movie about it and becomes world famous and changes lives. That's a goal. It's certainly worthwhile to work towards, and I would argue also very probable. However, it's not under our control. Like there are variables in there that we can't control. What we can do, however, is show up to this conversation with our values. So for me, the values that I picked out as I was coming into this was my value of curiosity, my value of adventure, my value of responsibility, which I lived by preparing, hopefully enough, and also my value of hope. And these values I can bring into anything we discuss here, and it's completely under my control. And I find that makes the concept of values just so incredibly powerful.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of times we think that we don't have choices in our life. You know, when we really value something, for example, we might feel as if we don't have a choice when it comes to setting boundaries with other people because we might be afraid of hurting that person's feelings. And yet, we might have choices that might make us uncomfortable, and yet it might be a choice that is honoring our core values, such as being authentic with a person that we care about.
So we've talked about loneliness and the aspects of it and the parts that it is made up of. Let's look at the way out of this. You have so many points in the book, so many exercises. I wish we could go through all of them here. We might not, even though in the James Cameron movie series, it's going to be, all of them are going to be in there. But why don't I just throw the very generic question your way and say, what do we do about loneliness?
I think the very first thing we can do is to name it. There is an expression that I really like, which is name it and you tame it. And I think admitting it to ourselves, right? Hey, I'm feeling lonely, can be really helpful. And then I personally and professionally believe that spending some time in solitude reflecting on what we're going through, whether it's silently thinking about our experiences or better yet, writing them down if possible, allows us to be a witness to our own experience. And I think when we can be a witness to our own experience, we can be our own compassionate friend. This is when we can have that connection with ourselves. What happens for many of us is that we go through something called self-abandonment, right? We try so hard to fit in with other people that we neglect who we are and we abandon the core of ourselves. When we spend time reflecting on our experiences, maybe either journaling or maybe verbally reflecting, some people like to use a voice recorder to reflect what they're going through, or sign language or anything that's acceptable for or appropriate for that particular person. But externalizing that experience and being a witness to what we're going through can allow us to have an understanding and acceptance. And then if possible, then to reach out to trusted people in our lives, or maybe even starting our own, let's say, loneliness support group, which is my dream. I'm hoping there'll be 8 billion support groups out there where we can share our experiences, where we can say, hey, you know, I just wanted to share with you, I've been struggling with loneliness, and this is what it looks like, and this is what would help me. Have you ever been through something like that? And rather than inviting the person to give us advice, we can invite them to share their experience. And I find that when people are able to say, you know what, me too, I've been through that too, I think that's when we feel connected, and connection is the opposite of loneliness. So the opposite of loneliness is not being around other people. It's connection, whether it's in person or virtual or in any way that it can happen.
There's so much in there. The first thing was that going through that exercise of naming it, taming it, writing about it, journaling about it, sounds like we would, for maybe the very first time, see, hear, value ourselves. It's like others don't see me, others don't hear me, but wait a second, I'm not even taking the time to validate this for myself and to sit in this for myself. And, you know, this was actually something that came up for me as I was going through your book. And I don't consider myself a lonely person. I'm an introvert. I like my solitude. I like my hobbies. I like to close my door and not see anyone. But when it comes to social activities, I thought, oh, no, this is, you know, I got this. And then I was going through the questionnaire that you have at the beginning of the book. And with every little row that I filled out, I was like, whoa, wait a second. There's a lot of loneliness actually in my life. Like, I wasn't aware of that, but spending some time in that, it's like, oh, that's where some of those feelings and thoughts come from. That, you know, I am going out, but not as much as obviously I'd like to. And that's where this makes its way into my life. And so it was a really interesting experience to find that and to then sit there with it and say, okay, you know what? This is what's happening right now. It makes sense that I'm feeling like this given what's going on. And now let's go out there and find those people that then will see and hear and value us. So apparently, the first step is to acknowledge this for ourselves, to be our own support first, then find support in others. If I remember correctly, there was also a piece in there, a chapter or two, about getting clear on what is important to us, what we kind of actually want from the people out there, so that we don't find what was the term you used? I think you used friends of convenience as opposed to the chosen family that we actually want to spend time with. And I would imagine that as a first step to finding that chosen family is get clear on what it actually is that we look for in those around us in that chosen family.
Exactly. It's finding people who do, right, see, hear, and value us, people that provide emotional safety instead of frequent invalidation or gaslighting or minimizing our experience, people who ideally share similar core values to us, right? And people that can understand and respect our friendship love languages. And so a lot of times we think of love languages as between intimate partners. And I included a chapter that talks about friendship love languages, which is how do we want to be supported and received by our friends, let's say when we're going through a hard time. Some people genuinely want advice when they're struggling. I think a lot of people just want someone to listen and validate them, or maybe to come over and keep them company, right? Or to send them a present, for instance, right? To say, hey, I'm thinking of you. Here's, you know, maybe a care package or something to that extent. And so I encourage people to think about what they need in their difficult time and to let their friends know. And so that there can be this conversation that people can have with their group, right? With their chosen family, where they know that when my friend is going through a hard time, this is what they would ideally like. This is how they want to be supported.
That is such a good point on do I offer a solution or not? I find that giving that, or at least maybe that's just my friendship language, my love language, but I feel that if I open up about a struggle that I'm having and the first thing I hear is a solution, that just invalidates the entire thing I just said. Like, I didn't need you to tell me read this book or watch this video or here are the three steps you should do and I will check in that you did them. It's like, no, first and foremost, the first thing I need is someone to say, oh yeah, that makes sense. That is really hard. No wonder you're struggling. I hear you. I see you. And I'm here for you. And then maybe can you give me a solution? I have any idea what I can do? But please let that not be the first thing that I hear when I share something like this. And I did a vulnerability workshop this weekend where I told everyone participating at the beginning, I said, you know what? I'm going to ask you some questions. And then I just want to go around and everyone answers the question in their turn. You can go as deep or as superficial as you want. Also, please feel free to skip a question if you're not comfortable answering that. And you're not allowed to give any solutions. All I want you to do is sit there, you know, maybe have the heart emoji up in the chat, but just be with that person. And when that person is done talking, please don't jump in and do your answer. Give them 10 seconds, 20 seconds to just let them feel heard. And that was actually the feedback that I got at the end, was that a lot of people said, you know what, those 10 seconds, those really hit home for me, because I realized when I stop talking, people are still listening and processing and they're still with me. And in those 90 minutes of workshop, there was not a single solution that was being offered. And at the same time, at the end, everyone said, you know what, we're so much more connected right now. I feel so understood. I feel like I've known you all for, you know, a lot longer than I actually did, because solutions weren't the first point in the agenda.
That's it, right? And you created such a lovely space for everyone, right? Where you created what's called emotional safety for everyone. And because the intention was not focused on solution, on rescuing anyone, right? The only intention that you requested of everyone is to be present and to listen and to give themselves the permission to participate in any degree they felt comfortable. People were able to really hear each other. What a lovely way to set up a group, right? And create emotional safety for everyone. Yeah, well done.
Thank you. Thank you. I find that especially with vulnerability, it's something that, well, I work a lot with men, so that might be different in other genders. And for the men that I work with, there needs to be a step-by-step plan. Like, how do I become vulnerable? How does that actually work? How do I share so that I'm heard by the other person? What are the steps that I need to do so the entire thing is safe and nothing can happen? It's like, unfortunately, that's not how it works. There's no hack to that. This depends a lot on your values and the people you surround yourself with. And let me show you how this works in an emotionally safe environment.
So lovely. I love how you structured it. It sounds like a wonderful group, and it sounds like a really, really safe environment that you created.
It's an incredible group, yes.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
So we talked about seeing, and I'm using seen for all the three attributes. First, see myself, then find others that see me. I would imagine that there's also a step that brings then in that chosen family that I might not only find in support groups for people that struggle with loneliness, but that I find by going to events, by going to parties, by doing things with my life, which I can imagine is for someone who's been isolating and struggling with maybe anxiety or a lack of social skills, like going out and then finding those people sounds like a scary endeavor for many.
100%. I think that for people who struggle with anxiety or phobias, for people that have been isolating for a while, these individuals are the bravest individuals in the world, right? Yeah. Because you're now taking active steps to face the scariest thing out there. Yeah. There's nothing more courageous. And so some of the questions I invite folks to think about is, if you were to spend some time with individuals, how do you want to spend that time? If there was to be a safe environment for you, what would you want to be doing and how would you want to be supported? And then looking for groups that engage in those activities or offer that kind of value. For example, at the start, it could be a support group such as the one that you offer, for example, right? Where folks know that going into it, that people are not going to be judging them or criticizing them. So it could be a support group at the start. And then thinking about the activities they would ideally want to engage in, such as playing Dungeons and Dragons. For example, with other people, right? That might mean joining a local or virtual Dungeons and Dragons group, right? Maybe making cosplay together, maybe joining a book club. But it might mean thinking about what does emotional safety look like, right? And then what kind of activities you'd want to engage in. I think those are really good first steps to start looking for a chosen family.
Yeah, we had in the first episode that I did here with Psychologists Off the Clock just a few weeks ago, where we introduced Emily and myself as the new hosts, we were also talking about things that we do for fun. And I told this story where just a few years ago, I was mentally going through those activities that brought a lot of fulfillment and fun and belly cracking laughter and smiles into my life. And those were all things that I loved to do as a kid and as a teenager, playing Dungeons and Dragons, remote control toys. I correct my friends all the time when they call them toys, remote control race cars, and playing video games and doing art. And before I even knew it, well, of course, I started those hobbies, but before I even knew it, I was surrounded by people that were into those same hobbies. I was out in the city with my best buddy and we were racing two remote control cars and a dad with his kids came along and he said, hey, have you heard about these cars? You know, blah, blah, blah. And I said, no, we haven't. And he said, well, I have a couple of them. Why don't you come visit and we'll take them for a race? Next person in the group. And then, you know, playing Dungeons and Dragons with friends and finding new friends and going to conventions. So in order to give, for the lack of a better word, a sort of like manual on how to do this, find something that truly invigorates you and that you love doing, and then find other people that also love doing that.
Exactly.
Yeah. Did I summarize that correctly?
Yes, beautifully. Yes. And think about ways that it would be an emotionally safe and validating experience for you. And that's the second component of it, right? Is being heard. How do you want to be heard, right? So practicing validating yourself, let's say by journaling. So there's an exercise I like to do with my clients, which is called journaling in two parts. So for part one, the client will write their own experience as if they're sharing it with a safe person. For part two, they write a compassionate and validating response, such as, of course you'll feel this way. Or it makes sense that you feel this way. I hear you. I understand you. I support you. I'm here for you. And so it's a way of a person practicing hearing themselves and then thinking about maybe even specific phrases to ask the people in their chosen family to practice saying to them. Some people think that it's not okay to do that it's not okay to advocate for ourselves or to ask people to give us specific maybe words of affirmation or words of support, but it is perfectly okay because if an individual really cares about us, I imagine that they would want to know the most helpful thing they can do in that moment. And similarly, we would want to do the same for them. We would want to know the phrases or the actions that we can take to help them.
Absolutely. I'm reminded of one of my best friends who, after a few phone calls or meetings, I would then the next day get a voice message that said, Michael, you know what? When I shared this and this, I didn't really feel supported by you. And that stung a little bit. What? I'm not perfect. What are you even saying? And then I was like, wait, this took a lot of courage for her to tell me. And yes, I can agree or disagree with it, but this was a clear ask for her on how to show up in her life when she's sharing something that she's struggling with. And I took note. I was like, okay, the next time I'm in this situation, this is how she needs to be supported. And since I want to be that person who supports my friends, this is how I need to show up in order to be of support. And yeah, I still remember listening to the voice message or reading the text and thinking like, ouch, ah, dang. And at the same time, yeah, that's necessary. And I wish I sometimes had the courage to be as direct and self-advocating in that regard and let other people know like, hey, actually, you know what? This is not cool. I need you to show up a little bit differently when I share something like this. So I shall make that something on my to-do list to work and refine.
I love that. And it was so courageous of your friend. You're absolutely right. It was so courageous of your friend to reach out to you. And how wonderful that you were able to take in that message, reflect on that, and learn from that experience. And also, I think you're absolutely right that it's something that we as humans struggle with and also would be helpful for us to do with other people. So I hope you do. And I know for myself, it was incredibly scary when I've had to give and also receive this kind of feedback from other people. But ultimately, in both of those experiences, for me, I was really grateful if someone either gave me feedback or was able to accept mine.
So there's one concept that you describe in your book that I felt helps so much with bringing about the beauty that is out there in the world and our friends and our chosen family. And that is the concept of savoring. I loved it when I read through that. Can you talk a little bit about what savoring is?
Sure. Yeah. So savoring is a mindfulness practice used in many different mindfulness practices. And it has to do with really noticing that really sweet or gentle moment. So savoring could be based on our senses. For example, when we're drinking a delicious cup of tea or coffee, savoring the taste or if possible, the smell of it. It could be savoring what we're looking at, for example, seeing a beautiful bird outside. It could be savoring a moment, maybe a moment in solitude, a moment of silence, or maybe a moment of lovely music, a moment with a loved one. And so it's noticing the loveliness of that moment and really feeling every sense of it. And I remember there was this one moment where I was in the car with my partner and our son, who was 9 years old at the time, was sitting in the back seat and he was singing a song from anime, from Tokyo Ghoul, actually. He was singing the opening theme, which I don't know if you know the opening theme of Tokyo Ghoul.
Why don't you sing it for us?
It's a heavy kind of song, you know, and I think the lyrics are something like, and in my heart, I'm so damaged, or something like that. It's quite a heavy song. And so you have this 9-year-old boy who has, you know, that childlike, innocent voice who's singing this song. And I started cracking up. And it also just warmed my heart, you know, to see him singing a song from an anime that he enjoyed watching. And just noticing, like, oh, hey, like, I'm having this lovely moment with people that I love. And so it was a simple moment, but it was so lovely that I'm always going to remember it.
So taking everything in, recognizing that this is a precious moment, and then just soaking it up and creating that memory that involves all the senses. And maybe even more important than forming the memory, like being present with that amazing moment that we find ourselves in.
Exactly.
To me, that chapter really spoke, because while I think I'm fairly good at having leisure time and hobbies and doing those things, I oftentimes find myself rushing through them, which is so ironic when I catch myself doing that. I was like, oh, I have to do this, and then it's finally done. It's like, yeah, but you're actually doing this because it's fun. It's not about like getting it done. So slow down, breathe, enjoy what you're doing, and really sense everything. And books are sometimes good examples where I'm like, oh, I finished another page. It's like, you're not reading the book to finish it. You're reading the book to enjoy it. So can you please do that right now and slow down? It's not about the outcome. It's about what you're doing here and now. And that just adds so much quality, especially to those precious moments.
100%, right? I think so many of us do that. I know that as a recovering workaholic, for me, it was very much, for many years, was what's next. And so I might be at a wonderful Halloween party, for example, but in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, and then when I get home, I have to clean, and then I'm not savoring spending time with people I care about, you know, being in a cool costume or, you know, celebrating Halloween. And so, yeah, being in that moment, not just mindfully, but also really savoring that experience, I think can allow us to experience the joy of that moment, right? And being fully there. And yes, in the next moment, something else will be happening, but can we savor that moment, that second, that experience?
Now that I listened to you in the Halloween party experience, for me, I think the savoring kryptonite for me is food. I love cooking, and I love shopping for groceries, and I cook some amazing meal. And I have to admit it, I watch my favorite series while I'm eating. And then I'm sitting down, and by the time the intro music has finished, my plate is empty. And like, how did that even happen? It's like, how did I just do that? This is definitely something where I need to dial up the savoring quite a bit.
I think that's something that we could all probably use, right? There's nothing wrong with watching television. And I think that if we can savor these experiences separately, when possible, right? If we can savor the experience of having dinner and then savor the experience of watching our favorite show, I think that we can enjoy both, right? Yep. If we can do them sequentially, perhaps.
So there's one last thing I want to come back to, because I realize with the savoring, I've kind of jumped ahead a little bit. When we talked about finding your chosen family in these activities that we love doing, something that you write in the book is that if that group doesn't exist, why don't you create it? Why don't you start organizing one? Do you have any tips around that or any experiences?
Yeah, absolutely. And so in the book, I shared about a client of mine. So in the book, I called her Rita. That's not her real name. So I'm going to use the name Rita. And so Rita was a client of mine for a number of years, and she's someone who struggled with loneliness. She was going through a really horrific injury right at the start of the pandemic. So not only was there a lockdown, but Rita was also recovering from this injury and couldn't leave the house anyway. And so Rita joined a virtual AA group and then started greeting the members of this group with a lovely greeting that she herself created, which is "Hello, family." And so she started every morning when she would join this virtual Zoom group, she would say, "Hello, family." And then so over time, other people started responding that way too. And they would say, "Hello, family." And so just by creating a loving greeting, Rita started facilitating this connection, which didn't exist in that group before. And then last year, Rita decided that she didn't want to spend the holidays alone. And she figured that there are probably other people that are also maybe going to be alone for the holidays. So she started a holiday party. And it was supposed to be kind of a small gathering. And I think something like 40 people ended up showing up. And everyone was so grateful that she hosted it. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is that if there is a club, a meetup, you know, some kind of a support group that you wish existed, chances are there other people do too. Yeah. So if, for example, you wish there would be some kind of like a board game group or a book club group that doesn't currently exist, if you were to start it, chances are people will show up. Because just as you're wishing that it existed, there are other people who do too. And by you starting it, you're essentially creating the very group you wish existed out there, and you're building out your chosen family that way too. Yeah.
So from my own experience, that might be, of course, be vastly different than everyone else's, but I was often surprised by how easy that was to get people together. I remember one time I had been away from Vienna, Austria, where I currently live for a couple of months. And as I came back, I had a lot to celebrate. And I didn't feel like organizing anything because I'm potentially energy efficient. So I just created a Facebook event and I invited all my contacts. And I said, hey, we're going to have, I called it the pink fluffy unicorn party that we're going to have in the park. And all I did was invite everyone and say, hey, you know what? I'm not going to organize anything. We're going to start at 11 in the morning. We're going to go open end. Please bring a blanket, sunblock, and whatever snacks and drinks you want. And 40 people showed up.
Nice.
And then afterwards, they're like, hey, can we do this again? And so it need not be like the most complicated thing or topic or whatever it might be that needs to be organized. Sometimes something small like this might suffice. And on the other hand, now that we went through a pandemic and everyone knows how Zoom works, it's suddenly incredibly easy to organize things online as well. It's arguably maybe not the same for everyone to meet online instead of in person. And at the same time, if your chosen family is spread across the globe or is spread across the country, I would argue that better to have a chosen family that's mostly online than to have friends of convenience that are nearby and don't always see, hear, or value myself.
Yeah. Absolutely. One of my favorite examples of chosen family doing good is the Supernatural fandom.
Mm.
There's an American TV show called Supernatural, and it's about two brothers who are basically monster hunters. Mm. But the essence of the show is what they go through. They go through a lot of grief, a lot of trauma, and they, no matter what, they support each other and they support their chosen family. They meet other hunters, other monster hunters, and they will do anything and everything to support their chosen family. Because of this show, people all over the world have started posting hashtag SPN family, so Supernatural family. And people all over the world meet either on Zoom or sometimes talk to each other on Twitch or through Twitter messages or now go to Supernatural conventions. But the point is, people bonded over the show because it addressed mental health, and they're now talking to each other about the characters on the show as a way of processing what they're going through and getting support. And many report that they found their chosen family within the Supernatural fandom.
Mm, amazing. And a great show. So we're almost coming up on the hour here. So in regards to the book, is there any topic that we did not touch upon that you'd like us to discuss?
I don't think so. I think I just want anyone listening to know that if you are feeling lonely or disconnected, if you're feeling unseen or unheard or invalidated by other people, please know that it makes sense that you feel this way and that anybody in your situation would be feeling what you're feeling. And so if possible, consider taking some time to reflect on what's been happening. And if possible, see if you can provide a compassionate response to what you're going through, because you deserve to be seen, to be heard, to be valued, to be reminded that you matter. And I hope that you know that you're wonderful. You're absolutely wonderful and you make a difference in this world. And thank you.
Thank you. Before I let you go, what are you working on at the moment? What can we look forward to next from Dr. Janina Scarlett?
Thank you. I'm actually working on a historical fiction book that is based on a true story, on my grandmother's story of being a Holocaust survivor in Ukraine and then having been enslaved during World War II. And so this is basically her account. So parts of it are fictionalized, but, you know, most of it is based on her real experience. And my hope is that with this book, people can, you know, understand what Holocaust was like in Ukraine. I'm hoping to share my grandma's story, her legacy, and I'm hoping that people will continue knowing the history so that history will never be repeated.
I can't wait to get my hands on that book.
Thank you.
Amazing. Thank you, my friend. Dziękuję moja podrucha. Thank you for being on the podcast. This was a huge pleasure, and I'm really glad I got this hour with you.
That is so sweet. Thank you so much. Dziękuję.
Thank you for listening to Psychologists Off the Clock. If you enjoy our podcast, you can help us out by leaving a review or contributing on Patreon.
You can get more psychology tips by subscribing to our newsletter and connecting with us on social media.
We'd like to thank our podcast production manager, Jadine Stout-Williams.
This podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only and is not meant to be a substitute for mental health treatment. If you're looking for mental health treatment, please visit the resources page of our website, offtheclockpsych.com.